Welcome to Business Watch, and we're talking about localization on the panel today. Thungela Resources, a major coal exporter which demerged from Anglo American in June, saw its share price fall last month when it reduced its production targets in response to poor rail performance. Now, Thungela and most other big coal miners are stuck. Their masses of export coal have always moved through the Richards Bay coal terminal by rail, and comments by Transnet CEO Portia Derby are revealing. Poor maintenance is obviously a big problem, while many of Transnet's troubles relate to procurement, she said, adding that the challenge of procuring quickly and competitively in the state is really huge. While Transnet has introduced a new procurement policy to streamline the process internally, approvals are still needed from the Treasury and can be particularly challenging when something is designated. For example, she said track rails aren't manufactured in South Africa, and yet there is a designation that says we must buy them here in South Africa. Now, you cannot imagine, she said, the time that it takes to argue about all of these issues. And I think it's a dreadful example of the costs of an ill-considered localization drive. Now, a recent Centre for Development and Enterprise-sponsored paper shone a spotlight on the policy of localization. And I'm joined now by Anne Bernstein, Executive Director of the CDE, and Saul Levin, who's an Executive Director of TIPS. Welcome both, and welcome, and perhaps you could just talk to the issues here that the report argues against, because the report argues that the case that's been made for localization is defective, it's unconvincing, and that it is economically myopic, and that it ignores the large but diffuse costs that must be paid by society, even as we do create small but highly concentrated benefits for those in business while we expand our response to effective localization policies. But first, what is localization? What do we mean? Is it import substitution? Is it designation? What are we talking about here?
Well, thanks very much, Michael. Good to be with you again. The two kinds of localization that we deal with in the paper involve this. The one is designated products that government agencies and SOEs have to procure from the domestic market. So that's the one. They're currently 27, they've just added cement, and they're planning to move to some 42 products on this list. The second kind of localization is an agreement at NEDLAC where over the next 5 years, some 20% of South African imports will be replaced by domestic manufacture, and all sorts of claims are made to grow the economy in terms of this. So it's a combination of imposed localization, local production, and enforcing that through government agencies, and then an agreement among the so-called social partners to try and get more localization going in South Africa through enforcing agencies like Transnet and others to buy locally.
And it's
should be noted that the government can't actually do this to private sector actors. They can introduce various sort of subsidies and tariffs, but WTO rules make this very impossible to actually enforce. So you can only enforce it through government agencies.
And there has been a lot of talk prior to COVID of buy local, and it really is one of the siren songs, as the report says, of localization. It has been a mantra of this particular administration, as effected through Minister Patel's Trade, Industry and Competition Department. But so how do you define localization in the way government is pursuing it currently?
So, I mean, we would see it in a much broader sense, and it's the strengthening of your local industrial capacity and an emphasis on industrializing or supporting industrialization in the country and job creation. And obviously for us, the benefits of industrialization and job creation are absolutely critical. I mean, we see localization as but one part of what government is able to do to support industrial development. But there's obviously ways of doing it well, and there's ways of not doing it well. So, I mean, we've seen throughout history, recent economic history, that some countries have got it right And used it effectively as a strategy to build a domestic market and then export on the basis of that, build competitiveness in those supply firms and strengthen the economy that way and grow economic development. But we've also seen bad examples of it where you isolate the economy, you overprotect the economy, your cost structure of your economy goes too high, so your input costs then increase, and you know, you don't become export competitive. So there's different ways of approaching it. All countries that have, well, not all, probably almost all countries that have successfully industrialized have done it on the basis of infant industry protection, growing their domestic industrial capacity, and using state resources effectively to drive that. So, I mean, I don't think it's a clear cut, you know, black and white situation where you can say localization is bad. There are elements that don't work, and there are elements that do work. And I think we need to understand the nuance of how these things are approached, and look at, you know, how it can be used successfully, and we take a stronger, you know, approach in supporting the competitiveness, building firms' capabilities, so that we are we don't have suppliers that raise the cost structure essentially.
And that's an important point there, and because the paper points to the diffuse costs often being glossed over by the proponents of localization, and I'd just like you to elaborate on how you see those costs playing out in a way that could potentially undermine the country's global competitiveness.
Well, look, firstly, Saul is putting forward a more nuanced kind of approach. The first point I want to make is that CDE is absolutely in favor of growing the South African economy. We need growth of 4 to 5% per annum, sustained for at least a decade and preferably longer, if we are to deal with our need for more and more jobs. So that's not on the table. We absolutely want that. What we're objecting to is the fairly blunt instrument that is contained in the government's economic recovery strategy of October last year, where localization is seen as a very important component of our growth strategy. And we're saying that the two approaches being suggested are not nuanced and are not the right approaches, and we're not sure this is a priority for South Africa now. What we need, and I'm sure Saul will agree, that there are very few developing countries that have succeeded without an export strategy. And we're saying, put your energies into getting all sorts of things right to make us a more competitive environment for exports and growing the economy. So we've got to prioritize power. We've got to prioritize rail. We've got to prioritize the roads and all sorts of logistics that are not working well, that are very expensive, that hold the country back. We also have to prioritize other areas. The president says he wants a much easier environment for business, less costly, less regulation. Well, localization adds to regulation and it is adding to costs. Now, in an environment where we have a weak state, and I think everyone can agree on that in general, this seems to us to be the wrong approach to encourage much greater investment in this economy and a much more competitive domestic economy, where we want new entrants. We don't want just the bigger companies to be protective, to lose or to have the risk of losing the incentive to innovate and to drive down prices. It's the wrong kind of approach for South Africa. Also, yes, there are other countries that try the infant industry approach, and it does sometimes work. But in general, what happens is some companies do benefit, but the costs for all of us, for the government, for consumers, for other companies, are generally understated. Think of the kind of service ArcelorMittal gives. Now, ISCO was protected, it was an infant industry, it's foundation of South African industrialization, But I think there are very few people today who would say that this has been a great success for South Africa. Companies in South Africa have to buy steel at import parity prices, and it hasn't made other companies in our economy more competitive.
On those points,
take the clothing industry.
Yeah, on those points.
Another example. So, in general, we're saying this shouldn't be the priority, and the risks of increased prices, less competition, less competitiveness are very, very high.
How are those on those points, Saul? How are those risks then catered for in a more nuanced localization policy and strategy in an environment where, to use the examples that that Anne has stated and also of what's going on at Transnet, because we have to procure locally, as the CEO of Transnet has said, we now make it more difficult to get our exports like coal to market during a commodities bull cycle. There are some very significant unintended consequences here.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we need to look at before we even get to that point is the cost of imports in terms of the tenderpreneur approach. The institutions that we've set up have actually, you know, in terms of that whole tenderpreneur with imports, means that three people sitting in a small office undermine local industrial capacity, and often the pricing is much more expensive. And so, you know, we need to fix those kind of things as well. You know, if we're looking at strengthening the industrial base of the economy, which I think is what we're all looking for here, is some of those unfortunate outcomes of some of the approach that we've taken to procurement has had a very negative impact. And so that becomes part of what we need to fix as we go through this procurement reform cycle. So that would be the first issue, is that, you know, when we're looking at the cost of imports, sometimes they are more expensive than local. There's an issue there. So then when we're looking at an approach of how do we get this right, so some of what we have been, and we are working with Transnet actually on their localization project, because we understand, you know, some of the complexities around this. So what do we need to do? And I know it's a bit early in your discussion, but some of what we've been looking at around it is saying, if you have a pricing reference system, so it does require a bit of sophistication, but some departments do have a pricing reference system where they're able to say, the benchmark price globally for these products is this amount. If we are looking at a way of making sure that our domestic industry is supported, they need to come in within that range so that we don't overpay because it's made locally. So there are mechanisms that can be put in place to avoid bulking or overcharging both of imports and of locally made products. So that kind of system could be in place. Other opportunities might be supply chain development. So what we've seen is, if you say this is the, and we can do it on a competitive basis, but you have to invest in a supply chain. If we look at the capabilities we have in South Africa, we've got firms with enormous capabilities, but they don't always get access to the opportunities, and sometimes they aren't globally benchmarked. So there is scope to say, okay, we, as a multinational SOE or a large SOE, we're going to be saying, okay, in compliance with the procurement requirements, we can find ways to still build our supply chain and make sure that our suppliers are competitive and can provide the products to spec as required. Mm. So there are mechanisms, and we do need to explore those kind of things.
What it does sound like, though, Saul, so sorry, I've just got to interject there. What it does sound like is a far more nuanced approach as opposed to what some of the policy proposals have put forward, which is, you know, a kind of target-based 20% across the board seems a very blunt instrument, versus a far more nuanced approach that, what sounds like to me, should be targeting the tenderpreneurs, targeting the root cause of the problem directly. Because as Professor Kaplan says in the paper, if you're forcing someone to procure locally, there must be a reason for that, be it a price or a quality reason. Otherwise, the market would be procuring at the best possible quality and price naturally. That's what markets do. So, I mean, how are these proposals skirting around those issues?
So, I mean, it's... I mean, part of it is we do need a more sophisticated approach to how we do our procurement. The 20%, though, I think was a consensus thing from NEDLAC rather than a government designation. As Anne had said, the government can't impose on the private sector. And the private sector understand how to build their supply chain. They're not going to be buying substandard products. You know, they're going to be making those investments. They don't have the same hamstrings of the procurement processes that government agencies do, and there is a reformulated government procurement process, which, you know, we need to then interrogate and say, how does this new approach allow for the sophistication and nuance? The people that we talk to in Transnet and in Eskom have capabilities. I mean, you do have engineers with decades of experience who really understand how they could get it right, but they feel hamstrung by the system. So we do need those changes, and we do need to bring in the level of nuance and sophistication. But just touching on something that Anne raised, just one thing that Anne raised about you know, the old ISCOR. I mean, one of the things that we see as a benefit of having infant industry protection and supporting the capacity building of these big, you know, firms to supply us locally, is that there's a lot of technology transfer, and Dave Kaplan understands this. We work closely with him on these issues around, you know, building industrial capability and, you know, strengthening our firms and, you know, technology capabilities. And those kind of things happen when you've got a strong lead firm that has got a lot of technology, and that technology transfers across industries. So, you know, these kind of things are important if you want to build your capabilities, is to have these big players.
And how do you respond?
So, a few things. The one is what I understand Saul to be saying is he's in principle in favor of localization, but he wants nuance and changes to where the state is currently at. So that's slightly different from what CDE is saying in our paper. We're saying if you look at what's in the government policy papers at the moment and the approach, it's holding us back. Let me give you an example from infrastructure. Private sector players are saying, and the Western Cape is saying, you force us to buy South African cement, you immediately put up the price of our infrastructure products. People in the private sector are saying, don't add yet another requirement, i.e. localization, to what we have to conform with in order to get infrastructure projects going, because it involves delays and costs. So I think, you know, if Saul and his team, very smart people, were in charge of a few items in the economy, that might work. I'm not arguing against that, if Saul and Dave Kaplan were, but those are the exceptions. What we've got to look at is the economy as a whole. Yes, we have to push up manufacturing dramatically, but I don't think we should do that by protecting local industries in general. You have to think of the impact on that on other firms, outside manufacturing, and consumers, and government. We're very short of money here. I think the priorities are to fix our abilities to export, to grow the economy and export. All the things, Michael, you're pointing out, where we're so bad. We're kind of the worst in the world in our port management and costs, in rail, which is collapsing. We've got the mining industry was telling us we have locomotives that are not moving because we don't have spare parts. And the problem is that they're not allowed to import those spare parts. So some mining companies are thinking they'll buy the imports to give to Transnet. This is crazy. So firstly, there's an issue of priority. Secondly, there's an issue of costs throughout the economy. And we need to quantify those costs, not just for particular sectors or firms. Then there's the issue of reducing the incentives to innovate and cutting off certain companies from the developments taking place in global value chains. And then I'd add another cost, which Columbia Professor Jagdish Bhagwati has emphasized in the Indian context and in general, which is if you've got a designated list and we're going to have private sector champions, you encourage firms to lobby to get on the list because domestic firms want to do that. So who wouldn't want to do that? So we, in a very inefficient economy, which is dominated in certain sectors by incumbent large firms, we encourage more of that. We encourage unproductive activity and lobbying. Mm. So for us, that seems the wrong approach altogether. Mm. Much rather put our focus on getting all the things that are wrong with our economy going, and that's how we'll grow jobs and the economy. And we need a growth strategy, not a protectionist strategy.
Saul, on that point, are we putting the localization policy cart before the growth horse in this country? And I hear what Anne is saying. These network industries that are binding constraints to broader economic growth have been identified by the Treasury as key constraints. Should we not just be focusing on reducing those constraints as quickly and as efficiently and cheaply as possible to allow the economy to grow, and then maybe start looking at where government can play a role in supporting specific sectors via master plans and champions, but that still then does come with the lobbying risk. But I just want your input on that.
I mean, we have seen in that growth strategy that government came out with, there was a strong prioritization on fixing the things that are broken. And I mean, we've also done our own work. We've analyzed the master plans and come up with a set of cross-cutting themes that come across all those master plans on big infrastructure that needs to be sorted out and fixed. And typically it's your electricity, ports, rail, and a few other things that are common themes that come across. And so these things, and you know, these things have been prioritized. There's Operation Vulindlela, which has been driving those fixes that need to take place. Fixing the ports, lowering the cost of the getting products to ports has been a priority. But we also need the industrial capacity. I mean, the risk of opening up the economy and, you know, just means that we if we get that wrong, then we deindustrialize. So, I mean, there's risks on all sides. You know, you go too far in you know, the route that Anne is talking about, and you risk deindustrializing. You go too far on the you know, the protectionist approach, and you risk undermining our competitiveness and slowing growth. There are risks on all sides when you're doing economic policy. So it is a tightrope that policymakers need to walk down. But you can't just say, okay, the one doesn't work in this extreme context. How do we then, you know, go to the other extreme? And so I think Anne wouldn't want to go to the other extreme either, because, you know, she as she said earlier, we do need to have industrial capacity. We do need the job creation. I think we all agree on that. So, I mean, one of the things we also need to look at, and it's something that was raised around cement, is that, you know, we've been looking at cement over the years with our import tracker, and we've seen, you know, various countries dumping cement into the South African market. You know, so it was, you know, one country was dumping, then, you know, a year or two later, it's another country that's dumping. So all of this, you know, we need to say, okay, when a product is dumped, sure, it's going to come in cheaper. But you know, we also need to have industrial capacity when, you know, you want to build buildings and you can't get the imported products because there's a global supply chain shortage. I mean, at the moment we've seen a lot of firms being quite keen to build local capacity. There was an article in the last few days around how firms are saying some of the shortages in China at the moment have just strengthened the need to have primary local steel capacity to supply the inputs.
I can just respond to that. So one, we have seen firms saying because of global supply shortages, there's an opportunity. Fabulous, take it and compete. That's number one. Number two, if there is dumping taking place in terms of cement, well, South Africa should go to the WTO. There are rules on how to deal with dumping. That is a different issue. But to then sort of slide to therefore we must protect our companies seems to me the wrong approach. So use the WTO to deal with dumping, but not in favor of dumping. Prove it and go to the WTO. What we're saying, though, is adding to the regulatory burden to force government agencies and sort of pressurize the private sector to localize supply of things seems to us the wrong approach. You know, in order to be an exporting country, you have to import. Take the automotive industry. They import all sorts of things in order to produce the car to then export it. And to arbitrarily cut ourselves off, which is what the government list of designated products does, we can't see any criteria, seems to be the wrong approach. So we're really saying, fix the logistics and make it a priority. This country's struggling to do anything at all. We have to have some urgency, some focus on priorities. That has to be the network industry, there's a logistics, and it's not good enough to talk about it. It's actually to get it done as quickly and as effectively as possible. And that's not happening. So in that context, to add on this whole localization drive, which partly, as you said, is to deal with the BEE being exploited in certain ways, well, fix BEE, you know, have a different approach to empowerment. I am absolutely in favor of more and more Black South Africans being entrepreneurs and part of a growing economy. Yes, let's fix that. But that's not a reason to localize. And in the view of both Dave Kaplan and Lawrence Edwards, two of the leading economists in the country, academic economists, and our own analysis, the localization has the much greater risk of holding back the economy than helping to grow the economy and more jobs.
Thank you. And we're going to have to leave it there. We have unfortunately run out of time. So much more to discuss around this issue. Really is fascinating policy, not just for policy wonks. It affects everyone in the broader economy. That was Anne Bernstein, Executive Director of the CDE, and Saul Levin, Executive Director of TIPS, talking about a new report produced by the CDE, the siren song of localization.